Blueprint Reviews.
So the real secret to living a better life is to be better informed and better connected. And our army of Blueprint reviewers around the country help you do just that with the films and TV that you should catch up on. And up first today we have John Page from Pages and Pages Bookshop in Sydney. John, what have you brought for us?
I've brought in All That Is Solid Melts Into Air by Daira McKeon, which is set in Russia in 1986 and follows the events surrounding the nuclear reactor meltdown in Chernobyl. Now, the story isn't about what led up to the meltdown or the actual meltdown itself, but it's the events after the meltdown through the eyes of four different characters. So the four characters, one is a gifted surgeon, Grigory, who is sent to the site to help coordinate efforts afterwards, and his ex-wife, Maria, who's an ex-journalist who's been blacklisted and can no longer work in journalism. And then there's two young boys, one Yevgeny, who is Maria's nephew, who's a 9-year-old piano prodigy who lives in the slums of Moscow. And then the other boy is Artom, who lives in a farm outside Chernobyl, whose life literally evaporates piece by piece after this accident.
I haven't come across Daira McKeon's work before. It doesn't sound like an obviously Russian name. Is this his first work?
This is his first novel, and he is Irish. So, yes, the question does arise, what is an Irish writer writing about Chernobyl? And the answer is a lot of the orphans from the accident were actually sent to Ireland in the 80s to live. And he grew up in a town which took a lot of these orphans along. So that's why he's always been kind of quite fascinated by this story and what happened. But what I found really interesting is the kind of the central to the novel is that he actually looks at the Chernobyl meltdown as the tipping point to the end of the Soviet Empire. It was they had so much kind of blind faith in the Soviet regime that this was the kind of the incident that led the Russian people to kind of doubt that they were infallible. I mean, they had no evacuation plans, there was no safety devices, because to have those in place would admit that there might be an accident, that they would make a mistake and this nuclear reactor would melt down. So they had none of that in place. There was no iodine, they just sent firefighters into the accident afterwards with no protection, no nothing. And their reaction to it was really the kind of the tipping point to the end of this empire. And, 3 years later, the Berlin Wall came down, and 2 years after that, the Soviet Union was no more.
It makes
And that's what I found
sense.
Really interesting about this story is that tipping point of the end of the Soviet Union through these four characters.
And John, just finally, when a work of fiction deals with a big historical event like this, or as you say, even a bigger sequence of historical events, sometimes the human story can get a bit lost. Does that happen here, or does McKeon bring the characters to life?
It's the opposite. The big event of the meltdown was very much in the background, and it is about these four characters and how each of their lives is changed either dramatically, like in the case of Artem, who's living on a farm outside Chernobyl, or even just slightly, the slight changes that kind of happen to Yevgeny, who's the prodigy. So it's that typical great kind of Russian bit, almost novel, where it is about the characters, it's about their lives, not about the kind of the big events in the background that are affecting them.
It sounds amazing, John. That's Daira McKeon's novel All That Is Solid Melts Into Air, and it's widely available from all good bookshops, I understand. Thanks heaps, John.
Thank you.
We're also joined now by RN's own Jason DeRosso. Jason's brought in a film that I absolutely adored when it came out.
The people! The people! The people! The people!
There are 70 million people watching. These pictures are going around the world.
We must make a massive demonstration.
White, black, and otherwise. Come to Selma.
I heard about the attack of innocent people. I couldn't just stand by.
Looks like an army out there.
That's A Taste of Selma, a film that I absolutely loved myself. Jason DeRosso, thank you for bringing it in. Tell us, why did this film resonate with you?
First of all, it's the story of Martin Luther King and this historic civil rights march that happened in 65 from Selma to Montgomery in Alabama, which kind of galvanized people in the civil rights era for the extreme police brutality that these protesters were met with on a bridge just outside Selma, a sequence that occurs in the film, that unfolds in the film, by the way, like a sort of symphonic nightmare. It's a wonderful action sequence full of sort of impressionistic slow motion shots and, well, basically spine-tingling drama and vicious violence. But I think, it resonates very much to a sort of post-Ferguson America. It got a Best Picture nomination at this year's Oscars and was sort of seen as being a little snubbed for the other categories, especially Best Actor. There's a wonderful performance here as Martin Luther King by David Oyelowo. But I think what I like about it most is that it's a film that shows interest in the periphery as much as the centre of official history. And there's one scene, for example, where Martin Luther King arrives at the airport, I think, and there's a white New York Times reporter who we return to again and again, sort of asking him questions. And ostensibly, the scene is about this interchange between this exchange between Martin Luther King and the white reporter. But the camera just sort of drifts away from this exchange and rests on the faces of this poor working class black family. And it's kind of more interested in their reactions, the mix of sort of apprehension and wonder and awe on their faces as they see this historic figure for the first time in the flesh. And I think the film does this again and again, directed, of course, by a black woman, Ava DuVernay, who really turned heads, I think, with her great direction of this film. And you know, it's a film that I think stands head and shoulders above your average historical biopic.
Jason, and, I agree, which makes it, and it's, you know, it's never a good thing to talk about whether someone was robbed in awards or not. But, you know, a lot of biopics were considered for the Oscars this year, and this one struck me as one that was doing something very different with a kind of notorious, well-travelled historical territory. Why do you think it was overlooked?
Well, I think to a certain degree, she's a relative newcomer to this level of filmmaking. This isn't her first film, but she probably, and the whole film generally, probably didn't have the apparatus in place to lobby effectively. But perhaps there is something to be said for the predominantly white, male, middle-class Academy membership that votes on these things. I mean, I think the real test of how successful the film was that she was then approached by Marvel to direct what will be their first film dedicated to the only Marvel black superhero, the Black Panther, or one of the main ones anyway. And she's since turned her back on that offer and cited artistic differences. But certainly she has been recognised after this film in perhaps a much more real and concrete way than an Academy Award might have
I'm not going to talk about what it means in today's age of cinema that it's a greater honour to be asked to direct a Marvel film than it is to win an Oscar. But Ava DuVernay's Selma is an extraordinary film. Thank you so much for bringing it in, Jason DeRosa.
You're most welcome.
And Selma is available on iTunes and other video on demand platforms. And you can always catch more of Jason DeRosa here on RN at 3 o'clock this afternoon with The Final Cut. Let's hear a little bit of beautiful gospel music from the Selma soundtrack. You're listening to Blueprint for Living with me, Michael Williams.
Guide my feet, Lord. Take, Lord, please hold my hand. My hand, precious Lord, and lead me home.